to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, a look at fuel cells and zero emissions. Jim Blair has invented a device which turns emissions from gas pipelines into mechanical energy. Wayne Hartford of Energy Ventures Incorporated has teamed up with the Alberta Research Council to commercialize a direct methanol fuel cell. And imagine getting double the energy from coal without burning it. That's the dream of Alan Johnson and the Zero Emissions Coal Alliance. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Not all emissions from pipelines and well sites are fugitive. Many are designed emissions, with methane deliberately vented to the atmosphere. That practice did not sit well with Jim Blair of Morin, Alberta. Calling upon his inventive mind, he came up with a way to capture that vented gas, put it to work, and keep it in the pipeline. I met Jim at his shop off Barlow Trail in Calgary's northeast. He was preparing to demonstrate his Blair Air system.
This is a piece of equipment designed to harness gas energy at natural gas wells anywhere, especially where you don't have electricity. And it takes that energy and converts it to mechanical energy and then compresses air for instrumentation or to operate small chemical pumps. It also has an optional plunger pump as part of the machine for pumping liquids.
Now, there's an environmental advantage to this. What's that?
Okay, with most pumps in the oil field, most pneumatic operated pumps, they're driven by natural gas because that's what's available in the field. And once the energy has been used to drive the pump, the gas is usually exhausted into the atmosphere. So you have methane going to atmosphere.
Where did you get the idea for your design?
This story starts out kind of like the first four words in the Bible. In the beginning, God gave me an idea, and I just developed it from there. I was operating in the oil field for almost 20 years and couldn't help but notice the gas being exhausted from pumps and instrumentation, and began to wonder if there wasn't some way to use the energy but vent it right back into the pipeline.
So we've got it operating over here. Can you explain some of the moving parts in that to me?
Yes, we're using, of course, shop air to simulate the gas because we're running in the shop. So we bring compressed air, which in the field would be gas, into the bottom of the big cylinder. That gas, as it develops pressure underneath the piston, raises the piston in the cylinder. There's a valve assembly in the piston that snaps open when the piston gets to the top of the stroke. Therefore, the piston falls as the gas goes right through the piston. When it gets to the bottom, that valve closes, and the cycle begins all over again. From that piston, we harness the energy through two reciprocating rods to drive air compressor cylinders directly and to operate a mechanical plunger pump as well.
Now, in trying to develop all of this and get it off the ground and to find acceptance with the companies that would be your target market, how's that process been going?
The momentum is picking up. We've delivered three units to the field now. We're still making some improvements to those units. We've got an order to bring another one to the field at the end of May. So we're getting more and more interest from the producing oil companies, oil and gas companies. That's where we're at with it right now.
Well, going through this process, what's it like being an inventor? Is this sort of par for the course for you, or is this something new, becoming an inventor?
I've tried a few things over the years, and I would say this is probably the first time I've been successful getting it to the market. I liked working with heavy equipment, and I worked on a pipeline plow for a period of time. I had some success, but it was never to get it able to get it commercial. This product was also quite a struggle. Once I began to realize I had something that might be patentable, I went through all that procedure and eventually did get a U.S. patent and then a Canadian patent. I struggled to try to get enough funding, of course, enough money together to continue development. And eventually, when I got the product to a certain point, I was able to get the interest of Etronix and license the product.
What's the advantage to a company that would install this? Is there an economic advantage to them?
Yes, there can be a fairly quick payout. It really depends on the well and on how much equipment is operating on gas and venting to atmosphere. Some of the large glycol pumps on gas dehydrators will vent as much as $10,000 worth of gas in a year to the atmosphere. At today's prices, it would be more like $20,000 value of gas in 1 year. So in 2 years, this machine could pay itself out, and the added bonus or benefit is that you've reduced your emissions to zero from that well site. At least all your methane emissions have been reduced to zero. These any areas of the province that are experiencing odor complaints from landowners and things like that, this machine is very capable of eliminating the methane emissions, which the landowners are probably getting the odors from, especially if the well is slightly sour. There's very often complaints from the landowners. So with the installation of this machine to replace existing pumps, you can reduce your emissions to zero.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for coming by and taking an interest in the machine.
That was Jim Blair, inventor of the Blair Air System. Next, fuel cells that use methanol. The bloom is off the rose when it comes to hydrogen fuel cells. Industry and researchers are now faced with the thorny issue of making hydrogen safe for use and transport. Of course, one can always sidestep those problems with a different fuel. And that's exactly what the Alberta Research Council is doing with methanol. That's what I learned from Dean Richardson of the Research Council's Technology Commercialization Division.
Well, the Alberta Research Council has a long-standing interest in fuel cells. Some of the first fuel cell activity in this province was led by Alberta Research Council scientists who've since moved on into the public or private sector. We're now into, I guess, what you'd call the next generation of fuel cell activity, and we have entered into a joint development agreement with a company called Energy Ventures, which will design and produce a direct methanol fuel cell.
What exactly would this do then?
Well, the direct methanol fuel cell has a number of applicable areas. I guess the first is the small portable application. So, for example, there has been work done, not here, but elsewhere in North America, on using direct methanol fuel cells to replace batteries in cell phones and so on. There is a class of application for what we call small portable applications, where you might be looking at 150 to 300 or 400 watts of power. And then there are the larger mobile applications. That is, maybe you're talking 2 to 3 kilowatts of power, but you might put it in something like a golf cart or a small utility vehicle of some kind.
You're talking about methanol in the fuel cell. Why methanol and not something else?
Well, all fuel cells work on the same basic principle. It's in some respects like a battery in reverse, but what we're doing is combining hydrogen and oxygen from the air to generate electrical power and water as an output product. Methanol has some advantages, though. Methanol is already available in industrial quantities worldwide. In fact, we have the world's largest producer of methanol based in Vancouver. So methanol has the advantage of being able to go into the existing infrastructure with a minimum amount of modification. What that means is potentially existing gas stations could be retrofitted fairly inexpensively to distribute methanol. And so there is an opportunity there to deal with this looming infrastructure issue. I mean, if we're talking about using pure hydrogen, there are significant challenges to developing an infrastructure to support hydrogen as a fuel, because it's obviously highly explosive, and so you tend to start having to deal with it in terms of trapping it in hydrides or putting it in high-pressure vessels or some other ways, and that's a very expensive proposition, particularly when you start looking at trying to make hydrogen fuel as ubiquitous as gasoline is now. You're talking literally tens of billions of dollars to make that investment. We think methanol offers an interim step because you can retrofit existing gas stations without significant expense. It's much easier to handle and control and so on than hydrogen gas or hydrogen in a hydride form is. So the other advantage to methanol is that, in countries that do not have fossil fuel, there is the opportunity for them to generate methanol from biomass. And so there's an environmental perspective there that we think has some merit in a lot of specific geographies around the world.
Why is the group that you're going to be partnering with coming to Alberta and not somewhere else?
I think they're coming to Alberta in large measure because I think we've got a positive business outlook. We have got some technology and capability inside the Alberta Research Council that is positive. And, we're bringing something to the table. We like what we've seen with our partner in terms of their intellectual property, and we think they're on the right track in terms of a collaboration strategy, and in terms of how we move in lockstep forward on coming up with a low-cost fuel cell.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dean Richardson of the Technology Commercialization Division of the Alberta Research Council. The man behind the direct methanol fuel cell is Wayne Hartford. He's the president and CEO of Energy Ventures Incorporated, an Ottawa-based company that makes batteries.
There has been a concept for years around a direct methanol fuel cell, and again, without getting too technical, it becomes hard to understand, but there has been a problem in what is called methanol crossover, and that is that the methanol itself is so similar in size, the actual methanol molecules, to the hydrogen and oxygen ones, that the methanol wants to creep into the system instead of just the hydrogen. If the methanol is in both sides, it's kind of like having a glass of hot water and a glass of cold water. There's potential between them, but if they're leaking into each other, you lose the potential. So we didn't invent direct methanol. We solved this crossover problem, which has stopped methanol for a long time from being an effective fuel cell. The historic solution for that was to put in a better membrane. That means adding a lot of expense and adding resistance to a battery. You don't want to add resistance. You want to go the other way. So we've made a much simpler, much less expensive, and much more effective direct methanol fuel cell.
If you could put it on the market today, where would it be used?
Well, I think the key that you just said, which is the exact focus we've got, is if you put it on the market today. The industry is about to be called up to put something on the market today. It needs to get out there so that people can get their hands on it and see what it's going to do. And again, a lot of the big players have been talking about going from the top down with great big huge systems. We believe that you need to start reasonably small and build up. So our first two prototypes are designed to be 250 watts and 2.5 kilowatts. A kilowatt is about 1.3 horsepower. So, you know, the portable generators that you often see are like 2,500 watts. That's 2.5 kilowatts. The 250-watt unit, ironically, was one where the military was talking to us about wanting a charging unit so that soldiers in the field who are using all kinds of batteries could use rechargeable batteries. When you're out there, how are you going to recharge them once they go dead? So this little 250-watt unit was designed to be a recharging unit for the military. Now, we started looking at broader-based applications for it. And the first thing we learned is a company called SRE Electronics that have come to us and said they want to work with us to provide all the electronic controls for this. The first thing they told us, which was a huge surprise because it's invisible, there are 250,000 electric vehicles manufactured in North America per year now. And a lot of people are going to say, you know, that's hard to believe. But what they are is they're lift trucks, they're golf carts, they're little people movers in the airports, they're the little wheelchairs, they're the electric carts that go around. The concern that people have with electric vehicles is what happens if I go from A to B and my batteries are dead? And the truth is, you are sitting there. That's all there is to it. The concept of using a small hybrid initially, and for example, use a golf cart as an example. If we put one of these 250-watt units on an existing golf cart, you've got a 5 to 5.5 hour period out on the course. Normally, if that was a hilly course, you'd have to bring that cart in and charge it for 8 hours before you could send it out again. With our 250-watt unit on board, it would be chemically charging the thing during the whole time you're using it. So now, instead of having three times as many golf carts as you need, because you can put people out at 6 in the morning and at 11 in the morning and at 4 in the afternoon, now you'll be able to use the same golf cart for all of those things, which becomes economic. So the 250-watt unit that we thought initially was going to demonstrate how this worked, and obviously the military would use it, which would be credibility, it's going to have a substantial commercial opportunity as a chemical fueler so that it can recharge all of these electric things that are sitting there.
That was Wayne Hartford, president of Energy Ventures Incorporated. His company has entered a joint venture with the Alberta Research Council to commercialize the direct methanol fuel cell. Coming up, zero-emission coal. Now, here's some thinking that goes outside the box. Instead of burning coal to get energy, why not mix it with water? Put it in the right fuel cell, and you'll get double the energy with zero emissions, and a whole new source of hydrogen for the future hydrogen-based economy. That's the concept that hooked Alan Johnson when he met two carbon scientists from Los Alamos. I spoke with Alan Johnson as he finished up his term as president of the Coal Association of Canada.
It's difficult to explain it in simple terms, but I guess the best way would be to say that they've developed a set of chemical equations that show that we can take coal and water into the first box, so to speak, and from that box get hydrogen and a pure stream of carbon dioxide out, so that within the box there are systems to remove all the sulfur and nitrogen and mercury and particulates and so forth. So that the first step then is to have coal and water coming in, hydrogen and carbon dioxide coming out. The hydrogen, of course, can be then used to make electricity or to drive automobiles or anything that you want to use hydrogen for. But more importantly, the carbon dioxide is in a pure stream, it's in a pure form, and it's hot and under pressure, so that it can be pumped into the ground into coal bed formations or for enhanced oil recovery, or just simply buried in saline aquifers. Or if you go to a more complete step, you can actually react that carbon dioxide with soapstone, or that's the very dark green soapstone, which has the technical name of serpentine. And the serpentine and carbon dioxide will form a white powder called magnesite, which some of your listeners might know as Rolaids or Tums or something. In other words, a very stable white powder that can be put back in the ground. So the overall system then is coal and water coming in, hydrogen coming out, and finally the carbon being put back in the ground as a safe, stable white powder.
Are there any other uses, or do you always have to have the hydrogen coming out, or is there some room for recycling within this process?
Oh, no, of course the hydrogen can be used right in the process. It can be put through a solid oxide fuel cell. And of course, in a fuel cell, it will react with hydrogen, with oxygen, to form water, and that water can be the water that's coming back into the system. So we don't, have to be putting coal and water in. We can be putting coal in and cycling the water around, so that we don't have to get makeup water for the process.
Well, how is this process different from what happens now when coal is burned to produce electricity?
Well, it's fundamentally different because you don't burn the coal. I mean, that's the key, the discovery, if you wish, was that you could get the energy from the coal without burning it. In the present systems, what we do is we take the coal, we burn it in air and nitrogen. That creates heat, which we use to make steam, and then we put the steam through great big turbines. The turbines, of course, spin at very high speed and make electricity, and then we get the electricity. But we have all the emissions from the burning of coal going out into the atmosphere. And of course, we try in many circumstances to put scrubbers and cleaners on to clean those emissions out, but we don't eliminate them. Whereas the process we're talking about now, the zero emission coal process, the sort of vision of the future, has no emissions at all. Everything is kept within the system.
So it looks like what we're going into here is a whole new fuel cell technology. Could you explain a little bit about this fuel cell, this new one that would use the coal?
Well, the main difference from existing fuel cells would be that this one must be able to handle fairly high levels of sulfur in the circulating gases that are going through it. Sulfur, but also things like mercury and nitrogen and so on. So the process, because it's being kept in a box, inside the box is not clean. There are a number of cleaning circuits in it that are continuously removing material, but the solid oxide fuel cell that needs to be designed doesn't exist today. The ceramic solid oxide fuel cells that do exist require very high purity hydrogen and cannot stand to work in high temperature environments like this with the things like the sulfur going around.
So if you're looking at these fuel cells, if we can just speculate what it might be like in the future, I'm thinking of wind power, where you've got banks of windmills all over the place in order to capture enough power to develop the electricity that's needed on a large scale. How then would the fuel cells be set up? Would they be like banks of fuel cells everywhere, or would it be something small enough that you could keep on a smaller scale, or how would that work?
Well, I guess if you drove by one of these plants compared to an existing coal-fired plant, the only thing that you would notice different is that there would be no smokestack. They would be essentially the same size. The fuel cells would take the place of the hydrogen, or the, not hydrogen, but the steam turbines. And so the space requirement would be essentially the same as it is today.
With this new technology, what other changes are involved? Does it change the way coal will be mined, for example?
Yes, it changes virtually everything about coal. It changes the way it's mined, the way it's transported, the way it's used. For example, in mining, we might be mining coal with water jets and then crushing it in the mine, mixing it with water, putting it into a pipeline as a coal water slurry or a sludge. And just instead of transporting it by truck or rail, just pipelining it into big tanks where it's held until it's used. We could be shipping coal over to Japan without having coal piles or coal dust or any of those things. It changes everything about coal. And on the other side of the equation, after you use the coal and you make the hydrogen, then coal becomes the foundation of the hydrogen economy. We no longer look to windmills and solar panels and things of that to be making our hydrogen to run the hydrogen economy, but we can look to coal with zero emissions to produce the cheapest form of hydrogen in large quantities, in quantities that are large enough to run our massive economies, and have no emissions.
How is it that you got connected with the scientists from Los Alamos?
This is one of the most interesting parts of the story, actually. I was, just after I was appointed president of the Coal Association, about 2 weeks after that, there was a meeting being held in Calgary that I wasn't invited to. It was held by the federal government, Natural Resources Canada. And they didn't mean not to invite me. I didn't exist just before that. So when they found out that I hadn't been invited, they invited me to the meeting, but when I arrived there, there was no seat for me. But there was a space at the table, beside Dr. Ziark, who was from the invited guest from Los Alamos. And the purpose of this meeting was to look 50 years out and discuss in very broad terms what the world would look like and how technologies would change in 50 years. And one of the surprising things was that everyone at the table, all these senior people from major oil and gas companies and so on, were all talking about things like changing the amount of flaring or improving this technology or improving that technology. And when we got around to Dr. Ziark, he started talking about grandiose schemes about anaerobic gasification of coal to produce hydrogen, and frankly nobody understood what he was talking about. So during the coffee breaks, because I was sitting beside him, I turned to him and said, "Can you explain to me in sort of simple terms what you're saying, like what this means?" So he explained it to me, and I thought, "Gee, that sounds really interesting." And after the meeting, I sent him a one sentence email saying, "Dear Hans, it was really nice to meet you, and I'd like to follow up and talk to you some more about this." So then the next thing you know, I was invited down to Los Alamos, and they gave me a complete dog and pony show of all their carbon management programs. And at the end of the meeting, Dr. Cheryl Berger said to me, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, it looks great, but I can't do anything about it." She said, "Well, what do we need to do?" And I said, "Well, you need $1 million. And you need a program, you need a business plan and a technical plan." And so she just looked at me and said, "Well, can you help us do that?" And so we just came back to Canada and visited the power companies and the federal government and the Alberta government and so on, and told the story and asked everyone for a small contribution, and they all said yes. So we just started it up just out of a sort of serendipity happenstance meeting that I had with Dr. Ziark. Just one thing led to another, and the idea, once it was explained and a simple person like me could understand it, the idea was so compelling that we found that it really was very, very easy to get very significant companies and government entities to work with us to make it happen. And so it's on its way now.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome, Cheryl.
That was Alan Johnson, formerly of the Coal Association of Canada and founding member of the Zero Emissions Coal Alliance. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Check out our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.